Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. The political climate around climate research is tough right now. Today, we learn more about a recent report that flags our storm drains connected to the Alawai Canal that they could fail before 2050. We hear about a sea voyage to study a volcano in the Aleutian Islands. Could it trigger a tsunami of its own? We meet the new head of arts and culture for the city. She's the third person to fill the post during the Blangiardi administration. And we take a spin with a 76-year-old bus driver who's been behind the wheel for 40 years and counting. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Countdown to 2050, that is just 25 years away, and researchers are flagging that sea level rise and our flood risk is something we can't ignore. It is later than we think. This week, University of Hawaii researchers will meet with the mayor about their findings. Their work was published last month in Scientific Reports. It cautioned that Waikiki's storm drain system that empties into the Alawai Canal could fail sooner than we think. Chip Fletcher is the dean of the School of Ocean Earth Science and Technology, known as SOEST. He, along with Chloe Obara and Shelley Habel, have long studied the very real threat facing our communities. We featured Habel's work with groundwater inundation in Waikiki earlier this year, but Fletcher starts us off.
I'll begin with some context. Sea level rise is real. We've been measuring it by satellite for 30 years. During that time, the rate of global sea level rise has doubled. In fact, a little bit more than that. And the melting of ice and the thermal expansion of the ocean are the, up until a week or two ago, the major components driving sea level rise. But a paper came out a week ago telling us that the human use of aquifer water on continents, and then discharging that water into the oceans, now is a greater source of water to the oceans than the melting of all the ice in the world. That was pretty stunning. It has its own implications. But thermal expansion of the ocean is one that I wanted to point out because the oceans are incredibly large and they have what's known as overturning circulation or vertical circulation. And for a parcel of water on the surface of the ocean to go through the whole conveyor belt, the vertical circulation of the ocean takes over 1,000 years. And the whole time, thermal expansion is taking place because we're sending down into the deeper ocean thermally expanded warm water from the surface, and it is causing thermal expansion as it travels. So my point is that sea level rise is essentially a permanent condition. It's not something that will stop once we manage to stop emitting greenhouse gases. It's not something that will stop, for instance, when global warming stops. It's going to continue. And so all of our government agencies, all of our communities need to think very hard about this because it's going to cause flooding of many different types, which we can talk about. And it's going to be unrelenting, accelerating, and inevitable at this point.
I think the startling numbers, right? Was it 2050? That a lot of our storm drains could fail? I don't know, Chloe, talk about that because it's pretty sobering.
Yes. So the work that me and my colleagues did was essentially looking at the condition of the storm drainage network in Waikiki and then applying different scenarios of climate, be it sea level rise or rainfall events, and just understanding when we can expect to see failure and where across Waikiki we'll see failure. And yeah, we found that by 2050 or between 2050 and 2060, which is when we expect to see 2 feet of sea level rise, that's when we're going to start to see really significant failure or flooding at a lot of the inlets in Waikiki.
And then, Shelley, I've followed you around Waikiki, checking the levels in your research. It is something we have to face because it's not going to go away.
We really do need to look at drainage failure and how Alawai exacerbates that, because the Alawai is basically an estuary. So it's influenced by things like the tide and by rainfall. So the confluence of that. And about 3/4 of our drainage system drain into the Alawai. So once it reaches a certain level, it can start backflowing through parts of the city. And that's concerning because we all know that Alawai waters aren't clean, right? So all the Alawai includes things like urban contaminants, sewage, all sorts of pathogens. And so it is really concerning that with big rainfall events, water from the Alawai could be getting into the city now. And with sea level rise, that could be a more chronic condition.
Yeah, I know when we talked to the former EPA head who came out here from Region 9 doing a site visit, and he was like, yeah, the Alawai is a degraded waterway. And Chloe, I don't know, when you were out there doing your survey and your modeling, what struck you about what you were seeing?
When I was walking across Waikiki to install the sensors we used, yeah, we found interesting things in some of the drainage, occasionally boogie boards or just like discolored water. And we don't know exactly what's going on underground. Those are some clues that potentially contaminants are entering the drainage system. And that's something that we just need to be aware of. And so that is a consideration with this modeling. Anywhere that we have water backflowing, where we know that drainage system is connected to the Alawai, there is potential for contaminants in that water.
So how many sensors did you put out?
We installed 10 sensors throughout Waikiki, and those were continuously monitoring the water level. And so we used that to both calibrate and validate our results to make sure that we were accurately modeling those water levels as we projected forward into the future.
And then how did you strategically, I guess, place them?
So we placed two transects from the Alawai to inland, essentially looking at the gradient of where we see the tidal signature. And we found that we did see a tidal water level change in every single sensor moving inland, even into the center of Waikiki. And then we also placed sensors in western Waikiki because we know that's an area that is projected to see effects of sea level rise sooner.
And these sensors were placed down in the storm drains. You have that metal grate on the side of a road, and they place these sensors down into the culvert. Is that right, Chloe? Describe where these sensors were placed.
So we essentially popped open the manhole covers and lowered the sensors to the bottom of that structure. So resting at the bottom of the pipe or the culvert, whatever was accessible from that entry point. And then we also placed three sensors at outfall locations where the water exits the system, two into the Alawai Canal itself, and then one into the Alawai Boat Harbor.
And then anything else that you want to add, what you folks were looking at?
We also measured salinity levels, which is important to think about when you kind of think about what our infrastructure is made of underground. It's a lot of irons and metals that can corrode. And what we found was basically ocean level salinities in a lot of our drainage systems just consistently.
So it's eating away at everything underneath there.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah. And so, Chip, you know, as you see the results of this study and knowing what you know about, yeah, this is real, and then the decisions that our lawmakers need to make, you know, about policy, because 2050 is not that far away.
It's happening now. And it happens in various forms. For instance, we just had a large swell event, a large wave event on the South Shore. And at high tide, those swell were running up onto the adjacent land. When it rains and it happens to be high tide, or if it's a king tide, one of those extreme tides that happen in groups twice a year, we see water in the streets. We see water in the gutters of the streets. And you may drive your car and splash through a little puddle and think, oh, it rained. It's not necessarily rain. It could be, and probably is, salt water coming up out through our storm drain system.
And good luck with the undercarriage in your car, right, with the rust.
That and with our buried infrastructure. A lot of it still is from 1950s, 1960s era cast iron. And that stuff is going to increasingly rust away because of the corrosion factor as more and more salinization, salt water contamination of the very polluted aquifer. Don't get mixed up with my use of the term aquifer. There is a water body we call an aquifer under Waikiki, but it's certainly not drinkable water. It's extremely polluted, and it's increasing the salt content as sea level rises. Shelley, in fact, has started working with the corrosion laboratory in the College of Engineering to get a handle on this question of the decay and corrosion of our buried infrastructure.
We've been hearing from co-authors Chip Fletcher, Chloe Obara, and researcher Shelley Habel from the School of Ocean Earth Science and Technology. There is to be a meeting with Mayor Rick Mangiardi this week to discuss their findings as officials grapple with our risk of flooding and sea level rise in Waikiki. We'll hear more about the studies underway with the UH College of Engineering right after a short break.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Merriman's Restaurants on Oahu, Maui, Hawaii Island, and Kauai. Details and reservations at merrimanshawaii.com.
Writer Alexis Okeowo says Alabama, where she grew up, shows the best and worst of the American experiment, its blessings and disasters.
The Native Americans who managed to stay, immigrants like my parents from Nigeria, those people and their visions of what Alabama could be is what has pushed the state forward.
I'm Amory Sievertson. What can we all learn from Alabama? That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2, following the world.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training, and the Rice Partnership.
Let's get back to my conversation with scientists at the University of Hawaii. So West Dean Chip Fletcher mentioned that researcher Shelley Habel is working with the College of Engineering to learn more about the impacts of rising sea level on our underground pipes and other critical infrastructure.
So our thought is to recreate the conditions that are going on underground in Waikiki. And with that, kind of installing these little things they call coupons, which are made out of different metals that our infrastructure is made out of, to see what are the things that are corroding the infrastructure. Is it the dissolved oxygen, the microbes, et cetera? There's various different causes. And yeah, so that's really exciting work we're doing and looking forward to helping infrastructure agencies and management agencies with their planning based on that research.
Yeah, modeling like the rate of deterioration.
Right,
kind of,
and the types of deterioration that's happening, because these things can corrode at different rates based on if a pipe is totally submerged in groundwater or the groundwater is influenced by the tide. So if you have a pipe that is dry part of the time, wet part of the time, as you have those high tide, low tide intervals, or if it's dry consistently all the time, it'll experience different rates of decay. And so understanding that a lot better will help with our planning.
You asked me about policy, and I just wanted to mention that the City Department of Planning and Permitting has a project called Waikiki 2050, and it is focused on the very problems we're discussing here. They are using our models from the university to help understand where the storm drain failure problem is, where groundwater inundation, hotspots for groundwater inundation, hotspots for wave run-up, coastal erosion, compound flooding, which is rain at high tide. All of these are different impacts of sea level rise that all require their own style of modeling and all require different unique adaptation responses. And they've written a hazard profile of Waikiki that discusses all of these, plus other hazards like tsunami and earthquakes, as a first step towards identifying potentially some actual adaptation projects, which I hope to see some actual earth moving happen one of these days. And I have to say, I'm very proud of the City and County of Honolulu because they are not hiding from this problem. They are addressing it, and they're being very scientific about their approach.
We have a lot at stake, right? We have Waikiki just on the other side, or economic engine, but we have so many people who live in and around that area, and it's a key artery to get around on that side of the island. Chloe, the report also talked about possibly pumping some of the storm drains if there's like too much water.
Sure. So an example that I cited was the Miami Beach area, and they have a very similar condition to what we're seeing in Waikiki, where they are a very low-lying coastal urban area. And one of the solutions that they've looked to is pumping their drainage. So instead of relying on gravity to route stormwater into the ocean or into the Alawai, we could consider some sort of pumping mechanism. But I leave that to the engineers and experts to figure out. That's just a case study that I was looking at as an example.
But do we pump it, let's say, on the Alawai golf course?
Or we pump it back into the ocean. It's called recycling. I was lucky enough to take a trip. There was a combined trip to Miami Beach back in 2018, 2019, with members of the city and county of Honolulu, various agencies with the state, and then university researchers. And we got to see one of these pumps that they're putting in. And as part of this, they raise roads, they raise sidewalks, and they gently tilt them all towards the pump station. And so every block or two, there's a big pump station. Now, these pump stations are big. You actually climb a set of steps to get up and operate it. And the pump itself takes in this runoff from the streets, as well as in Miami Beach, they have groundwater. They call it blue sky flooding, groundwater rising up through the ground and storm drain backflow. And that will run off to the pump. The pump will strain it for large objects, removing them, and it will also expose them to ultraviolet radiation. So it's partial primary treatment, and then they are allowed by the EPA to discharge it into Biscayne Bay, which is the lagoon behind the Miami Barrier Island.
Okay, but my question is, what if there's a power outage, and what happens to those pump stations?
Yep, each pump station should have backup power, maybe a battery or something, yeah.
Okay.
It's a good question.
Interesting. I don't know. Any other final thoughts that you think you want to leave the listeners with, Chloe, just about the research and what we need to be focusing on going forward?
I think another thing to consider in this work was we were looking at rainfall events in addition to sea level rise, because a lot of sea level rise modeling has been done in this area, but lesser modeling has been done that incorporates rainfall and looks at what happens when we have storm events. And so anything we can do to relieve some of the pressure on the storm drain system would be helpful, whether that's green infrastructure or permeable pavement. So there's a lot of small scale solutions that on a parcel by parcel level folks can look at too to help address this problem.
Okay. And then Shelley, I know you're still doing work down there in the area. Any, I don't know, final thoughts for our listeners?
No, we're just going to continue to look at what groundwater is doing. It's very shallow within all of the Waikiki area. And so we're just trying to wrap our heads around how that shallow groundwater is affecting our underground and low-lying infrastructure and just keep going from there.
And Chip?
We're expanding our research around the whole island. Our modeling for coastal erosion is finished around all of Oahu. Shelley is expanding her groundwater modeling up the windward side across the North Shore and into Waianae. These models take very talented people. We have to pay them, of course. It's my job to assist with writing grants and finding funding. And our goal as a group is to build a resilient future for the state of Hawaii, to assist communities to be resilient, because we're entering a future that's going to look very different from the past.
Yeah, and there's so much we don't know yet about hydrology and geology.
Yeah. There's how will the island, how will the shoreline and the coastal plain, the coastal areas respond to rising groundwater, rising sea level, and the increased intensity of rainfall? It's all, the city has a project called One Water, and very smartly, they are looking at all the ways that water is in our lives and trying to figure out efficiencies, shortcuts, and improvements for how we deal with all this water.
Okay, One Water. I have to find out more about it. But thank you all for carving time out for us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've been hearing from Shelley Habel, Chloe Obara, and Chip Fletcher about the very real threat of Waikiki's storm drain system failing due to rising sea levels and increased rainfall. They plan to meet with Mayor Rick Blangiardi later this week about their findings. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz.
Unihoa, Ulanai, O Maui, O Kahoolawe, O Hawaii.
In the 1950s, fields of orchids could be seen all across Hilo, so much so that it's the reason why Hawaii was named the Orchid Isle. No orchid was more popular than the Vanda, Miss Joaquim orchid. The flower is originally from Singapore and the country's national flower. Its popularity erupted after World War II, and it became a huge export for Hawaii, selling under the name Princess Aloha Flower. The flower was used for lei, float decoration, and corsages. And at the peak of popularity, more than 700,000 blooms were flown across the nation on chartered planes. Exports to the continental U.S. were as much as $1.5 million a year. However, the popularity for the flower eventually faded, and the prices dropped from 35 cents a bloom to 100 blooms for 1 cent. While the Vanda Miss Joaquim is not an orchid that's native to Hawaii, all orchid varieties offshoots share one Hawaiian name in the orchid community. For today's backyard quiz, can you name these clones of the mother plant? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689. The first one to get it right gets an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nairit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are working to provide affordable housing programs to transition renters into homeowners, such as Hawaiian Community Assets. NairitHawaii.com.
This weekend's classical music performance with Megan Conley for Live from the Atherton series is sold out. We are adding another show, same day at 2 p.m., so you have a chance to come. Don't miss this opportunity. For tickets and more information, visit hprtickets.org. Sponsored by HMSA.
Support for HPR comes from Osher Lifelong Learning Institute for ages 50 and older, with courses from art and film to history and gardening. Classes begin September 22nd. OLLIUHM.org.
A Hilo scientist recently returned home from an expedition that was years in the making. Ashton Flinders is a research geophysicist with the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory in Hilo. Flinders trained as an oceanographer and spent time aboard the research vessel Atlantis investigating the Baugoslav volcano in the Aleutian Islands. Flinders led the volcano, earthquake, and landslide hazard component of the expedition, investigating the potential for the volcano to trigger a tsunami. He spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender about the expedition, starting with the similarities between the region and Hawaii.
Unalaska is actually really, really similar, in my opinion, to Big Island. We're both islands in the middle of the Pacific that doesn't have one day Amazon Prime. We both have volcanoes in our backyard. We're all familiar with the volcanoes on the Big Island, especially Kilauea and Mauna Loa. On the island of Unalaska, they have an active volcano, Makushin. That's one of their primary hazards. The island is largely owned through a native corporation of the Unagan people. And so there's those type of perspectives and communities that you're communicating to and want to be respectful of and really understand what are their priorities. And then, of course, aside with the volcanoes, we both have huge tsunamigenic threats, both from a lot of the tsunamis that impact Hawaii originate and are generated off of the shelf of Alaska in these areas. And so they feel the effects, you know, much more quickly than we do. Alaska in particular, and the tsunamis that have been generated from great earthquakes along the Aleutian Arc, have often been associated or hypothesized to be larger than would be expected just from an earthquake. And the way that's been hypothesized to be generated is that the earthquake causes a large either subaerial or submarine landslide. And so you can imagine if you have your two hands underwater and you rub them back and forth, that moves the water a little bit, right? Just that displacement of that material. But If you have a bowling ball and you drop it into the water, that makes a huge splash and a huge wave. So that bowling ball is the equivalent of a submarine landslide or subaerial landslide, a bunch of material coming into the water, displacing that water, creating a wave that propagates across the Pacific. Those landslides can come from a few different kind of geologic provinces or geologic regimes. One of them can just be failure of the continental shelf off of the volcanoes, and a part of it, just like we have a continental rise as we come to the mainland, there's a slope break and then the water goes from really deep to really shallow. Part of that slope fails underwater and slides downward. That was the hypothesis for the 1946 tsunami that caused up to about 165 deaths throughout the Hawaiian Islands. One that's really relevant to me because I live on the Hamakua coast, just about 5 miles south of Lapahoehoe, which is where the group of children and school teachers were killed in the tsunami from that 46. Every time I'm driving from my office home, I pass the little lighthouse in Hilo Bay that has the high watermarks of all those tsunamis. The other way that these submarine landslides or subaerial landslides can generate tsunamis is not from the shelf break, not just a failure of a pre-existing slope, but from a volcano, an edifice of a volcano, the mountain of a volcano, being shaken so much that it actually fails and part of the volcano slides away and creates a tsunami. So when we're thinking about tsunami-genic threats, things that can cause tsunamis in the Aleutians, we have those slope breaks, but we also have the volcanoes. A lot of the volcanoes, well, a lot of the Aleutians in general, but also the volcanoes, are poorly mapped in their bathymetry, in their submarine topography. And so one of the ways we constrain that and characterize that is by going out and mapping it. Bogoslav, one of the reasons it's a potential tsunami-genic threat, I mean, it's very understudied, so it's still really hard to know how concerned we should be about that threat. It's the unknown unknown, is that when we have these large explosive eruptions like we did in 2016 and 2017, and a bunch of ash and rock gets thrown into the air, as it falls back down, it lands in the water, it then drops through the water column, it drops through the water and settles on the seafloor, and that builds up the flanks of the volcano. So the volcano is not just built by, you know, what we think of here in Hawaii, you know, these passive lava flows that we associate with Kilauea. It's actually much more akin to almost what we're seeing now, not directly akin, but just a relative model to the fountaining that we have at Kilauea, where, you know, we have these fountains that are throwing up this very poorly dense material of tephra that's landing on the volcano, and it's building this tephra cone, this pile of tephra that's actually 100 feet tall right now. Very similar process, except instead of just these Hawaiian fire fountains going on, in Bogoslav, it's having these huge eruptions, subplanean eruptions that's throwing ash and rock tens of thousands of feet, but it's still settling back down and building up the flanks of the volcano in this really poorly consolidated, loose mixture of stuff, of ash and debris. And that stuff is not firmly in place. That stuff can fail. And as the volcano builds on top of that, you can imagine you're building a house on a sandcastle. Eventually that house might get so big that the sandcastle beneath it fails and that house gets wiped away. So that volcano might be growing and growing, but if it's growing on this poorly constrained material, eventually that could slide away. And that's that second way we can generate these really large tsunami-genic threats.
And so one of the questions there with the mapping is to figure out where these piles might be being built up, what might be the less structurally sound bits, what could be in danger of falling. Share more about the expedition and some of those questions and, you know, what even like your day-to-day was like when you were out there.
The expedition, the ball got rolling on it about 5 years ago. It was, the charge was led by the primary investigator, the PI, Cheryl Morrison, who was with the USGS Ecosystems Group, so the US Geological Survey Ecosystems Mission Area. Cheryl actually retired right before the cruise, so she spent about 5 years working on this, but didn't actually join us on the expedition, unfortunately.
It's like planning a birthday party you don't get to go to.
I know. We brought a cutout picture of her in the submarine as in spirit, and we were texting her the entire time. But it was really a cross USGS and cross agency collaborative effort. So big group of people, the ship, the RV Atlantis, the research vessel Atlantis, well, it's owned by the Office of Naval Research, but it's run by the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. The ship has space for about 65 people. About 24 of those are scientists in terms of capacity, And I think we had 22 or 23 scientists aboard. So we had a full group. And then, of course, we had all the ship's crew who make the ship run. And then we also had about 10 people who are just associated with the submarine, the human-operated vehicle, Alvin. Among that breakdown of scientists, we had three people focused on the mapping and the submarine hazard portion and the geology, two people associated with the minerals, and then most of the other people were from either the ecosystems mission area that I already mentioned, and a lot of them were biologists. I was interested in the Bogosloth portion and the mapping, but one of the primary missions was constraining deep ecosystems and looking at the resiliency, the health, corals, fisheries, sponges, all the squishy stuff that I don't really deal with in my day-to-day. And it was interesting because we actually had a scientist aboard, Chris Kellogg, who had done some submarine work there, almost about 20 years ago. And so it was actually coming back to some of the areas that were visited before and seeing how healthy they are and see how their lung is. And that ecosystems portion was really important, not just for the science side, but also for the stakeholders on Alaska, because it's really supported, their economy is supported by fisheries. And so they want to understand the health of their local ecosystems. The day-to-day will greatly depend on who you ask on the expedition. A ship like this, there's always something going on. And so we're running 24/7 operations. And so although there's about 22 or 23 scientists aboard, most of my time was actually spent with one or two of them, because we drew the lucky straws, or the short straws, depending on how you look at it, of doing the dogleg watch. So the dog watch. So I was up, my normal routine was to get up around 6 p.m., wake up at 6 p.m., have a bowl of cereal around 6:37, and then be in the mapping lab where we run all the ship's acoustic sonars by about 7:50 p.m., at which point the person who had been running everything before takes off, and I start my shift at 8 p.m. And then I work from 8 p.m., I do a 12-hour shift to 8 a.m. And so I'm up for 3 weeks while almost everyone else is asleep, except my colleague, Kathleen Young, from NOAA, who was assisting in running the sonar systems and then responsible for our geographic informational systems, or GIS. So she was making all the maps and then also helping clean the acoustic data. So the day-to-day is wake up when everyone's asleep, have cereal for dinner, hope you remembered to put some dinner in the fridge from the night before so that you can have dinner for breakfast, and talk to two or three people at 3 a.m. And of course, everyone's asleep, so something always goes wrong. If you're behind schedule, or you have to move to avoid something, or you see something out in the distance. And so it's those kind of 3 a.m. fire alarms that you're wondering, okay, what do I do now? I'm not waking anyone up. It's an interesting experience. I always like those midnight shifts, because there's camaraderie in being a zombie. Mm. You know, there's only three of you awake and you get to know each other real well. Yeah.
So talk a little bit about what comes next. I imagine this was a trip, an expedition 5 years in the making. Is it going to take the next 5 years to sift through everything that you've collected? And what's usually the pace at which you put out some of these findings?
Yeah, it's really dependent on the science that we're investigating. Some of the scientific products will come out fairly rapidly. All of the new sonar data that was collected is already in queues at NOAA, National Center for Environmental Information, NCEI, and it'll probably take about a year for it to go through the full process, but we'll have new maps coming out from Alaska in a year timeline from when the data was collected. I started working on a research paper related to a potential tsunami source for the 1957 tsunami that we mapped. And I started working on that paper while I'm out to sea. And so I'm already working with co-authors and colleagues with the hope that I can get it out the door fairly quickly. That's not necessarily always the pace. I'm back now at my normal day job monitoring Kilauea and Mauna Loa. So I got to try and strike while the iron's hot and not lose momentum, because I also have responsibilities here and I have projects I'm working on.
Yeah, in between eruptive episodes.
Right, like a frantic week worth. And I don't want any of that Alaska work to detract from my Hawaii responsibilities. And the quicker I can get it done and get feedback from colleagues and get some research out the door, the better for me, the better for my colleagues, and then also the more quickly I can inform the public of what might be important to them. Some of the biological work, I don't even know. Some of the things that they collect get immediately sent for DNA sequencing and get subdivided into other samples. I think there was 600 or 700 biological samples taken during this cruise, but then that was subdivided into thousands of splits. So it went to dozens and dozens of research scientists. And so they'll all be working on their own timelines, whether it forms one research paper or whether it goes into something larger and more comprehensive that's a longer-term project. So whole range of timelines from, yeah, hopefully months to hopefully 100 years.
Thank you so much for taking the time. Really appreciate it.
Oh, happy to join you.
That was USGS geophysicist Ashton Flinders and HPR's Maddie Bender. We'll have photos taken on board the research vessel Atlantis on our website after the show. And Flinders says if there's anything his work has taught him, it is to believe tsunami warnings. His advice, pay attention to civil defense. It has been a bit of a revolving door. Today we meet the new head at the Mayor's Office of Culture and the Arts. Jennifer Santos is the third person to take over during the Blangiardi administration. And HPR's culture and arts reporter, Cassie Ordonio, joins us to tell us more. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you know, and I'm just thinking, you know, that office has really done some wonderful things. The Wahipana, the Storied Places exhibit. There was that wonderful exhibit that Noe Tanigawa did down at the Natatorium. Just wonderful, you know, arts immersive programs.
Yeah, and like we were saying earlier, there is some high turnover for that position as well. And Jennifer Santos is coming in with a lot of ideas. She wants to rebrand the office, the Mayor's Office on Culture and the Arts. She also wants to provide more public access to art throughout the communities on Oahu specifically, and implement career development workshops for artists.
In the first couple of weeks that I've been here, I've invested that time in doing a listening tour with council members, COCA, our Commission of Culture and the Arts, department stakeholders, and heads who already have an ear on community needs. And we're leaning on them to set some of the direction as far as where's the opportunity. And some of the common themes as far as potential projects have been collaborating with nonprofits to mobilize into underrepresented communities. There's this notion that we're a little bit too centralized today, and so I don't want culture and arts to feel like it's a destination that our communities have to travel to go to. I want to be able to find ways that we can bring this offering to them. And ways that we can do that would be partnering with schools, local artists, surrounding small businesses, to revive underutilized spaces, spaces that could be repurposed for community celebrations, performing arts. Murals is a very popular thing, and something that I think we have an established blueprint for in a lot of the work that we see around Kaka'ako and Kalihi. And there are other districts who are voicing a want and a desire to do that. I actually recently, I have two children. They go to Kekula Kaiapuni o Anoinoi in Palolo. And one of the things that we were focusing on is ways to bring place-based mo'olelo to bear for the children in how they're seeing what they're studying and who they are in their journey and where they're located in Palolo Valley.
So I talked to other folks who know of Jennifer Santos, like Vince Hazen, who's the Chair of Commission on Culture and the Arts. I've talked to the principal of the school where her kids go to, Baba Yim, and they described her as kind of this firecracker when it comes to projects and how organized she is in articulating her thoughts and also putting the projects and implementing them. And she did say that she wants to expand, for example, more murals to different communities, and she wanted to use Kaka'ako and Kalihi kind of as the model.
Mm-hmm. When wonderful art there.
Exactly. And but Vince really wants to see more art in neighborhoods like Chinatown. He said that a lot of art artists have ebbed and flow from there. And they kind of wanted to kind of use San Francisco as a model to kind of have more murals beautify that space, kind of similar to Kaimuki as well. And for Jennifer Santos, she has more than 20 years of experience across corporate and nonprofit organizations. She recently served as director of strategy, planning, and operations for business acceleration at VMware, which is a company that develops virtualization software. And Santos, she graduated from the University of San Francisco with a degree in applied economics and a graduate degree in project management. And now she's currently attending the University of Hawaii, West Oahu, for a certificate in Olelo Hawaii. And what's interesting about Jennifer is that she actually is the first non-native Hawaiian to take the executive director role for the Mayor's Office on Culture and the Arts. She's of Chinese descent, but her husband and her kids all speak Olelo Hawaii at home fluently, and then also in public as well. So that was interesting fun fact about her. And so when I talked to Vince Hazen, who's the chair on Commission on Culture and the Arts, he's been on the commission since 2019, and also remembers working with former Mayor Kirk Caldwell's MOCA, our Mayor's Office of Executive Director. And he's met Jennifer Santos once, but he said that he's open to her ideas coming in.
I really hope that there is a bigger presence of koka in our community, that we are able to support our local artists and our organizations in a more meaningful way than we have currently. That's going to be someone who can help find those resources in a meaningful way and navigate all of the sort of bureaucracy of how do you choose who gets that and manage those projects. If you do fund something, then that takes a whole lot of management that goes with it too, and that's a lot of work. And so that's what those paid employees would need to manage that part too.
And Baba Yim, who is the principal at Ke Kula Kaipuni Onoinoi School, also described her leadership skills when it comes to projects.
Our school rebranding happened a number of years back, and it kind of started before they came into the school. And so what we're looking to do is it was actually just creating a newer, more updated and fresh logo for our school's athletics. But then that kind of grew into using that design and that brand on our new school uniforms. And when she came in, right, she helped really to kind of spread the word amongst parents and kind of get it out through communications and social media posts and other stuff, just to kind of get it more out and visual into the public. I think that was a lot of her key help in that.
So she's also working with Councilmember Tyler Dos Santos Tam, and they actually have a community meeting for artists at Capitol Modern today at 4 p.m.
All right. Okay. Well, we'll see how she does. But thank you so much, Cassie.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to HBR's Cassie Hordono. Check out her stories at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Aloha Air Cargo, offering 5 direct flights weekly from Honolulu to Seattle-Tacoma Airport. More information at AlohaAirCargo.com.
Today on The Daily, Congressman Mike Flood of Nebraska on the disappearance of the open town hall as an American political tradition and why, for him, it's worth preserving. I'm Michael Barbaro. That's today on The Daily from The New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30 following Marketplace.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply with a mission to provide fresh water to the people of Oahu, committed to conserving and protecting Oahu's water resources since 1929. BoardofWaterSupply.com.
Now it's time to put a name to the question that we posed in our backyard quiz. The origin of the name stumped us here at The Conversation, and our summer intern, Laura Dukes, asked around Hawaii's orchid communities and got this response written by orchid historian Carol Zakahi of Kona. She writes, with the name alone, you would think it started somewhere in Hawaii. The closest I got to any year that it may have been developed is about 1924, when Colonel Lester Bryan brought those cuttings from Singapore that developed an orchid sensation around commercial production of orchids. Mr. Herbert Shipman, Mr. Y. Hirose, Professor Edward White were all mentioned in this book, A History of an Orchid. It was published in 1972. No mention of keiki in this book, but maybe you can check it out. I found the book at the Nani Mau Garden Shop back in 2003. Did you catch that? The name of the exact clone of the orchid mother plant is keiki. The term has grown in popularity over the years to mean all of the offshoots of plants that can be used for propagation. And we stumped you on that one. We had no winners. But that's our quiz. If you have an idea to share, send it to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org. Uilani Sousa began driving a city bus in April of 1985. 40 years later, she's still at it. Over the course of that time, she's watched decades of change across Oahu as she drove one route after another. She's also raised 4 children as a single mother, and these days, her shift starts every morning at 3:30 a.m. and takes her through the streets of Aiea. The Conversation's D.W. Gibson went along for a ride with Sousa to hear how her work and her perspective has changed over the years.
Please hold on. The bus is departing.
My full name is Uilani Sousa. My bus route is 541-545. I wouldn't believe I would ever become a bus operator. It's a challenge, but that's okay. All these years, I got it already. I'm 76. That's why some of my coworkers tell me, Auntie, you must just wait to 80, because the way you look, you can wait to 80. I go, oh, my boy, I don't know about that. Only God knows. We take it one day at a time. I'm a grandmother and a great-grand. I was born here, and I grew up in Kailua. When we was growing up, you know, time was just ticking, ticking, you know. But now, when you're up in age, time is just moving so fast, you know. Days is just going, you know. So no more time to think or anything. When we moved to Kailua, I was 3 years old. We never had the tunnel now. We came on the Opali Road, that zigzag road. And we never had these kind of cars. We had the old 1940, 42, those not big vehicles for big families. Because back then, families came huge. And if my dad was here today, or way before that, he would be so proud of me driving one big bus. Yeah, because I'm the only girl, that's why. I thought about applying for the bus company because they was hiring females. And I did. I went down and I applied. I had an interview. I got hired. I went to do my physical and I started the class the same day. And we didn't have too much buses back then. And we didn't have AC buses. So, yeah. We had no power steering, no AC. We had the double clutch buses. You know what double clutch is? That's like driving one rig. Yeah. And if you don't get them into the right RPM, you have to slow down. And you got to crank them to first to start all over again. But back then was wonderful people. Loving aloha on the road, make our blinkers. Or we pulling into our bus stop, make our blinkers pull out, they wave on. That was the best. That was the best. Being a bus operator was something new for me to do, because I'm ready to challenge anything, to learn anything. And that's me, you know, like my dad said, if you want it, you go for it. Look at me now, 40 years, I'm still here yet. I drove so many routes, so many. And out of all of them, this is the one that is my favorite. And this is one of my regular passengers. Good morning. Today we have so much not well drivers. And we have a lot that cuts us off, you know. Yeah, sure, inside you're kind of mad, but then we don't let it. I don't let it bother me, really. I don't. I sense when somebody wants to cut in front of me.
when that person can just be patient, yeah, and wait to turn instead of cutting in between us just to get into there where they can cause an accident. So that's why we gotta be ready. Okay, we gotta drive defense out here. And me, one thing about me, I do drive defense as much as possible. We can make our blinkers. We waiting. We look in the mirror. Nobody let us in. They all speed up. But go and get some. Go and hit the highlights, which I appreciate it. And when I move into the next lane, I give them the shaka sign, which the button is over here, to appreciate, yeah, because my people is more important than anything else for their safety. And I want them to be happy, you know, when they get off, instead of being frightening, you know. So I won't stoop to anybody's level, you know. There's so much cars now out there on the road compared to when I first came in. It wasn't that much cars, wasn't that much people catching the bus. Today is a lot of challenging. You really gotta focus. It really can get to you if you let it to. The people can get to you, but you just let it go. But when they start doing something that I don't like on my bus, I will find out what is the situation, because we have a lot of fights, stabbings, you know, all kinds. Even us, we also get assaulted. And we don't come to work to get assaulted. We come to work to make a living. But as for me, I can handle anything out there with kindness, with a smile. People give me a lot of things, even on this line. I get watercress from Subita's farm, you know, he's my regular Filipino guy. He gives me a package of that, and aunties, they give me goodies, they give me Big Island cookies, you know, all kinds. I had a lot throughout my years. I had a lot of things, a lot. I even get people that don't catch the bus. When they walk in their dogs, they waving at me. I enjoy them, and I'm just so spoiled on this route. A lot of regulars. Yeah. They're so amazing and so wonderful. Hi. Good morning. Good morning. How are you?
How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Hi. Good morning. Every morning when they come on, sometimes I do have some that's not in a good mood, but I tend to change it, you know, to change their moods and just relax. And, you know, if they have an issue, I'm ready to listen, you know, and hopefully I can help them. And you'd be surprised. I guess they needed somebody to talk to, you know, and I want to listen, you know. And we became close families, you know, on this line. I have so many kapunas. They touch my heart in so many ways. I have young children, yeah. And even if I'm going on vacation, they tell me, no, auntie, we don't want you to go on vacation. When time to go home, I always get in my car and I'm going home. And then sometimes I forget myself, like I'm going home, but then when I see people at the bus stop, I'm pulling in to the bus stop thinking that, oh, excuse me, you know, I'm going home. I'm not working. All right, you have a wonderful day. Bye, sweetie. You too.
That was Uilani Souza talking to HPR's D.W. Gibson about her experience driving for the bus for the past 40 years. Well, that does it for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to hear from our chief elections officer, Scott Nago. President Donald Trump says he wants to do away with mail-in voting and voting machines. So what does that mean for Hawaii? What do you think about Trump's plan? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217. You can find the conversation on our website or on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.